are doing the pick-your-own now, you go back a generation or two, they started out, they were far more pounds or tons of strawberries, but then they got shipped, picked mm-hmm. and shipped, and we'll see how long the old pick-your-own thing lasts. They're in some ways that is also fading.
Really?
Just because there are fewer people. Well, first of all, fewer people maybe that have the daylight time. Many families, mom and dad are employed and can't just run off to the strawberry patch. Of course, that's why Saturdays and Sundays are so big.
Yeah. Did I ask you last time, and I may have because my memory is getting worse and worse, Harold, if Rose ever felt like an outsider coming in from the outside? Did I ask you that?
Bless her heart. Typical Rose, I guess. She had a way of getting along with people. Before she moved here and was approached, I guess, initially by Chester Mass, and then Brother Wanger brought her on board and was very, very kind to her, but he did ask that she wear a covering, and that is not something she had done in her lifetime. Right. Certainly, there were elders, like her aunts, for example, wore the covering up in mm-hmm. Pennsylvania, but not Rose. Yeah, little things like that, but for the most part, I think she felt pretty widely accepted. And let's see, that Francis and Edna gave us a place to live the first
year.
I
didn't know that.
Yeah, it was Rodney's...
Grandma's house, or...?
No, the trailer.
Oh, okay.
It was only a year or so, yeah. But still, to be generously accepted by Francis Miller was a pretty a pretty good gig. So that's perhaps a long answer, but I would say, generally speaking, Rose felt accepted. That didn't mean that we explored it a couple of times, but I wish we had had some way to help Rose connect with her precious roots in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, too. And, other than just visits, we never could pull that off. I even considered a pastorate in Pennsylvania at one time, and she teaching job there. Although the particular one she was looking at turned out they weren't open. So anyway, it never happened. But
I was just curious because it seems to be a generational thing. Because the generation before, everybody I interviewed who moved into the community, who married into the community, said they always felt like an outsider.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas our generation, the women more or less, no, I felt pretty comfortable here.
Yeah, so yeah. Do you think Bishop Creamer would have had anything to do with that in the early 50s?
He may have had something to do with that. Because
I've heard some people, my parents' generation, mm-hmm. Gordon Wanger, for example, would just be one example of that, just talk with deep dissatisfaction about the way Creamer employed his understanding of what it meant to be nonconformist and all that went with that.
So, yeah, well,
I mean, dress, for example, was just way.
He left the Amish church because he didn't think that the Amish preached a born again experience.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
And he wanted that.
Sure.
Found
sure.
That. That's
yeah.
why he left. But then I don't think he ever got away from the rules he grew up with.
Yeah.
Reading at the good time, I couldn't understand it. I didn't care. I was a kid. I had to hear my parents talk.
Yeah.
And hear stories later. But then reading the history and where he came from, it becomes a lot more understandable why he felt the way he did and how he acted.
Maybe in prior years, Kempsville Mennonite now, the BG Amish earlier, have at different times experienced the same thing. Some ministers there that on the one hand, you know, just like Kramer, felt very strongly about the born again experience, mm-hmm. and but in terms of worldliness, and there was still a strong just a strong guidance, I guess,
to remain
in terms of abstaining from well, I don't think it's computers anymore, but mm-hmm. But you know certainly TV and. Yeah. And radio, maybe to some extent, and certain kinds of dress, and et cetera.
One other thing that I hadn't never even thought about until I was talking to Roy Wanger's children, was your dad a deacon?
He was.
When you were a child?
He was. Okay. Well, I'm going to say maybe 65 or something like that. Not all of my childhood life, but...
A good part of it.
I'm sure I was a teenager, probably a young teenager.
Did that ever cause you any problems or feelings of not fitting in or being an outsider or anything negative?
I mean, looking back, I would say... I think that was fairly minor. I'd have to say maybe yes in a very, but more of it had to do with Dad's personal, like your father. I mean, he was always frugal and, you know, spending money for his stuff. Not a matter of, you know, how much was in the bank or whatever, but it was just in terms of the cars he bought or put into his house or whatever. You know, I suppose that had something to do with him wearing a plain coat until I was an adult, anyway, mm-hmm. 20 or early 20s, that he abandoned that. So little bit, but not anything that put me under anything like that. It wasn't something that caused me grief or anxiety in any significant way. Just. Maybe a little bit of awkwardness, as some of my friends didn't understand. Well, for example, I didn't wear a tie until I was like upper teens. Mm-hmm. That was probably because my parents had just sort of looked askance on that mm-hmm. a bit, but wasn't long until Dad was wearing a tie. So.
Yeah. Well, even if that would have been a few years earlier, but not many. When Dale and I got our first suits, we was a question, are we going to get plain coats or...
Really?
Or lay down lapels, and if we knew if we got lay down lapels, we were going to wear a tie. We were going to be one of the two. And we got to lay down lapels.
Yeah, interesting.
And the reason, because I had never considered it, because I'd never been in that role, that Roy Wanger's children that I've talked to, all Lois, Lowell, and I can't remember the older one now.
I have a little trouble certainly I remember Mary Lois and Lowell the best.
Ruth Marie was the other one that I've talked to expressed that they always felt a little outcast,
uh-huh.
primarily because Roy was a deacon.
Uh-huh.
And the way one of them expressed it was, well, we'd get on the bus in the morning, and, you know, the night before he'd had to go visit a family to remonstrate with them about something they were not doing correctly. And this may have been during the Kramer era, too.
Uh-huh.
And Roy, that family was particularly plain.
Right,
and
right.
Even in the early pictures when they were teenagers, before the Mennonite, the Virginia Conference, long before Kramer came along, began enforcing the plain dress.
Yeah.
The early settlers here wore all kinds, you know, ties, coats, open collars, whatever. But in all the pictures with the Wangers in them, they had plain coats on. Even in groups that nobody else did, you could pick out Roy or Powell very easily.
Yeah. Well,
anyway, and they just felt like, well, everybody else is talking about them because their daddy had to go talk to somebody's parents last night and they're whispering about it.
Yeah.
And I don't remember any of that ever happening, but anyway. You started first as an assistant to Robert Mast as pastor. What year would that have been?
89.
How did that come about? Did you feel called? I know they didn't have a lot.
Right. It was just a bit awkward. you know, not because it initially came about with Robert Mast. He caught me working. I was on tractor at the Schloss Farm mm-hmm. back here, and Robert stopped me. But I understand that he had also at the same time was contacting Merlin Miller and Chester Mast, and asking the three of us in a time of both his and Phil's disability, Phil more physical and Robert more emotional, mental, mm-hmm. if we could lead worship some Sundays and just assist the pastors. It didn't have a lot of, it certainly didn't have a, you know, large job description or mm-hmm. whatever, but can you help us out? So that's how it started.
So all three of you were
at that point. All three of us. And well, I think perhaps I've told you before. I don't want to run over this again and again. But so I've often thought about what, if anything, I might have done differently in the next steps. But somehow I emerged as the one who might transition from that to assistant pastor, and you know, that eventually found its way through to a congregational vote and so on without too much trouble, although I think Chester and I haven't really discussed this with them, but Chester and Merlin might have felt might have wondered a bit, well, how did Harold get to be the chosen one here? You know, and I really can't even answer that for sure. I guess maybe the one thing that Robert Mast would have known keenly is because he was at that time right there in Harrisonburg with me, but I was youth secretary or youth pastor for Virginia Mennonite Conference. Mm-hmm. So I'd had that experience for a number of years, you know, even before we moved down here. That's the beginning.
Well, when did Phil retire?
That is a good question.
Because you said physical. His was the Alzheimer's?
Phil?
Yeah,
well, whatever his dementia was, it was pretty, I don't know if it was classic Alzheimer's or not,
right.
But it was a dementia that, you know, caused him to operate differently than what most of us had known him for many years. To speak and act differently and so on. But I think he had, so I think that maybe what precipitated that was when Adona Nisley came in the second year following Robert to be lead pastor, and I was assistant pastor under Adona.
What year would that have been?
1990.
Okay, so it wasn't very long after that then.
That Phil, right. Phil, at that point, I think still had all or most of his capabilities and was often during that year or two, the early 90s, he was called on as a substitute pastor for Methodist Church down there. What's the one? It's right next to the development your dad did on
Good Hope. Good Hope. Off of
this is the one. It's on
Benefit.
Yeah,
yeah, right beside Homestead. It's Good Hope.
Yeah, Good Hope. Okay, I
that's where Linda and I were married.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
We were both living there in that subdivision at the time. You know,
okay.
Last night,
yeah.
You're both.
Well, anyway,
there.
Phil was what was his name? The guy who was pastor there then is Mark Christian. Does that ring a bell?
I knew Mark.
Uh-huh.
He was there a little
later.
Well, he may have been there at that time, yeah, because we were in the 70s, so it was before we were married, before Mark, but I knew Mark after that, so he would have been there then.
Okay, that would have been one example. Another one was the church on Kempsville Road, something Messiah. It was originally an Episcopal church, but Episcopal church was too far stretch for them, and mm-hmm. Phil would be called on to preach there, and there are others too. I remember those two, and both of those pastors thought very highly of him. So.
When Adonna Nisley was here, you were the assistant.
Correct.
Were Chester or Merlin still involved in any way?
Well, involved, certainly. I think, you know, Chester would have had some capacity, like teaching Sunday school,
right.
that sort of thing. Can't remember for sure, but I think Merlin would have been involved with some prison ministry with my dad at that time.
So how long was Adonna here, and did you step up to become lead pastor when he left?
I did. And again, that involved, I'm not sure when I got licensed, but I was definitely, I guess I was licensed in 89, but definitely licensed then, and I mean the license continued in 91, and it wasn't but a year or so till I was ordained.
What was the most difficult thing you found about being a pastor in the church you grew up in?
What was difficult was that I was very naive in coming into that kind of setting, and what I was naive about was that, you know, a large portion of the Mennonite church, maybe in particular Virginia Conference, were beginning to move away from that, you know, having the good old boy from home be the called pastor, but instead looking for a seminary-trained pastor, you know, with experience and so on. And I didn't realize how many implications that had. Well, just one example, when we had an interim pastor for 1 year, the first year that I had stepped out, that would have been 2007, I guess. All of a sudden, it was about, and Phil had to do this too, but about my exiting, you know, the call for me to exit from the... Well, a good example, you would understand this because you know the history here. But all of a sudden, now I'm forgetting first name. This would have been my, and I guess in some ways your Aunt Helen. Her mother was, what was her first name?
Dickerson, yeah. Sylvia.
Sylvia, thank you. Yes, see, you're a step ahead of me there. So, you know, Donnie was my friend, my peer, you know, same Sunday school class, Bible school, and et cetera, and the same age. So when Donnie drowned, I think without ever, you know, saying it explicitly, I think I kind of became the son that she had lost, you know. So at least we had a good rapport, you know, for all the years after that. And later as pastor, you know, had many visits with her and that kind of thing. The day she died, Shirley was with her, and Shirley called me to come over. And already, what was his name, Metter?
Jim Metter.
Yeah, Jim Metter was here. And so I did, you know, without giving much thought to anything except what I just told you about the friendship, long friendship and connection, that kind of thing. Well, you know, included in that was a conversation about would you have some kind of eulogy, or, and my standard response was something like, "What, you know, I'm not in charge of conducting funerals, but yes, I'd be glad to say a few words." And Jim Metter wasn't happy about that. So, and then having served 7 years as in an oversight capacity for seven other congregations that, you know, following that, I realized the best thing you could do before you exit a pastorate is work with your council in having a probably written understanding about what your role will be or will not be as the new pastor or interim pastor comes in. We never had that with Jim Metter, it was just really an unnecessary tension. His wife would, I saw this happen, you look over and, you know, announce to Jim that I was present the few Sundays that I did show up for, you know, whatever reason, something special. And I said, this is ridiculous. But nevertheless, I worked with some other pastors in other congregations where, so if the interim pastor did gripe, the council could pull out, this is our understanding about what we have here, and you know, just chill, you know.
And perhaps solve it before it ever happened.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody understands.
Right, exactly. So that was the most difficult thing. It was actually post-pastor, but, you know, okay, so this is the thanks I get for serving the church as pastor, that, you know, the interim guy that comes in, you know, takes offense at
Did Merlin, was Merlin the assistant pastor at some point during this?
Yeah.
When did that happen?
That would have been very shortly after Adona went to Deep Creek then. Adona was at Deep Creek for a number of years following that.
Okay.
Following his time at Mount Pleasant. Well, let's just say 93, 94, or something like that.
Early
90s. Yeah, early 90s.
And he was here how long?
Merlin?
Yeah.
I think he was 4 years in that capacity.
Did he go when he left here?
That was the emergence of...
Did he go to Lansdowne?
Later, but not... Initially, he and my brother Daniel and Dorcas and Merlin and Linda were starting... they had a name for that.
Okay.
That church. It was...
Yeah, I wasn't even aware that ever happened until Kelly was telling me about it.
Okay. Yeah, she would have known about that, right.
I think she and Brent went there.
Perhaps. I didn't remember that.
Didn't Deanie and Shaheeny also go there? That was the first time I'd ever heard about it, when we were in Albania last year.
Okay.
And because Deanie was talking about it, they went because your folks went, because...
Well, Mom and Dad definitely did attend there.
And Deanie and Shaheeny were going wherever your Mom and Dad went.
Yeah, okay.
The admiration he had for your dad is just immense.
Yeah, well, I always appreciated that. He did see Dad pretty much like Dad was, you know. So that's where Merlin went.
To go with that.
Yeah, and then Keith came on a year or so later. Interesting, he's back on now as associate pastor. But I would say, well, I think Keith also was 4 or 5 years.
Did he leave before you did, or was that simultaneous?
No, he left before I did.
Merlin did, but Keith didn't leave until after Sam left. About that.
Well, yeah, that's, well, since you asked, I want to be completely graceful here and recognize that I too made many mistakes. But after Medor, who was here for what, a year?
A year, I think.
Yeah, he might have extended that a little bit. But
Can we hold that thought and back up one little teeny bit? Because Medor didn't come here until you had resigned, right?
Correct, right.
All right, and Keith was still here then at that time? Or had he...
Yes, I can't tell you for sure if at time I left, if Keith still had a licensed assignment or not.
And I don't remember, but Meadow was here when we came back.
Okay.
To back up to that again, what was the reason for you leaving?
I think, and again, I'll never be sure this was a call from heaven or anything, but I think for me it was a combination of having felt I had done my best and had reached approached some goals where I got stymied, and I made many mistakes here, but, you know, moving the church and the school to one location up here. Actually, you know, in 2004, some of us had a dream that the school would look very much like it does now. And that would include, recreation availabilities, recreation space availability beyond the school, a church, or maybe several, using the facility. And I think for understandable reasons, that failed. Some people ask me, why can't you just kick in again now and go forward, you know, having... But that coupled with the fact that, see, it was 2005 that Burgie's Dairy Farm collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you know this, or I've told you this before, I don't know, but, Mom and Dad had looked to rental income on the property here as their basically Social Security supplement, and they didn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did, along with some of my siblings, felt some obligation, compulsion that, you know, that this is a time we need to step in and do something. So those two combined, I guess, the failure of 2004 and then demise of Brady's Dairy.
Okay, and Jim was hired just for 1 year or for whatever the short time he was here. He didn't expect it to be a long-term sinecure?
Well, that was certainly the way he was hired, but at the same time, he was unemployed as a pastor when he was hired, although he'd had a pastorate previously. At least it seemed to me, even though I was outside of the loop a little bit there, that it wasn't hard for him to make some noises that he'd be open to stay longer.
Mm.
The church stuck with whatever it was, a year or a year and a half arrangement. But then just to, at this point, Sam and Keith and Jim Metter all kind of come together.
How did that happen?
Well, so here's at least, well, I think even though I was on the outside, I think I have a pretty good understanding of what happened. So following Metter, search committee, pastoral search committee, had made several contacts, you know, I don't, maybe all over the...
Who was on the committee, do you know?
Robert Mass chaired it. I can't name, you know, all the people on the committee.
And it'll be in the minutes?
Yeah. There was a candidate who was interested in Mount Pleasant. He had made a quiet visit here, as I understand it. I don't think I still was not attending here at Mount Pleasant at that time. But he had made an initial visit that didn't introduce him to the whole congregation. And he, along with the search committee, had reached a point where he was ready to come for, you know, that trial sermon and, you know, more generally more widely meeting the congregation. Still not voted in or anything, but at the same time, Keith and Sam together had said, you know, the committee's searching and we would be glad to take the assignment together, the two of us. I think, again, you know, definitely strongly preferring the homeboys. It sort of left that guy hanging, the candidate who was ready to come, and basically nodded to Sam and to Keith that they would be delighted about that, even though, again, there hadn't been a vote yet. But but as far as the committee was concerned, they were thrilled about this. And so that's how first the...
Was Sam still at New Life then, or had he left New Life?
Well, he certainly had contacts with New Life. I think, you know, he was pastor of one of the New Life churches. I think he had already discontinued that. Better not quote me on there, because I'm not absolutely sure. But at any rate, whatever, he was free enough that he was...
I've already interviewed Sam, by the way.
Okay.
I was going to talk to him again, but...
It depends on who you ask as to how well that went initially when Keith and Sam were together. Well, maybe I'll just leave it there.
No, go ahead.
Well, I would... My observation was that the idea of having Keith's place of business be the only place where you could access the pastor directly, face-to-face. Initially, they weren't keeping any pastoral hours in the church. So, you know, that was awkward for any number of people. Maybe not everyone, but, you know, who wants to... a confessionary or whatever in the insurance business location. But there would have been some other things as well. But at some point, Keith moved out of that situation. Maybe you already know more about... Well, actually, maybe Keith didn't move out of that situation until Sam said he was leaving.
That was 6 years later?
More or less, yeah, something like that. I'm actually not sure about how and when Keith left.
Yeah, I haven't talked to Keith yet. And I'm fuzzy in my own mind.
Keith stay on a little bit, or who went first? That is...
When I talked to Sam, he didn't remember.
Yeah.
He just went through and said, well, you know, he resigned because they had the vote, and it was 50-50, and he knew he couldn't remain with that kind of stuff. So he resigned.
Sure, and that's understanding.
How involved were you in the original setting up of Lansdowne? Were you involved in that at all? And what was the impetus for doing that?
To start with, I would not have been involved with the exception. Do you know what year that was?
78.
79. Yeah. Just, I guess, just, you know, encouragement, support. I knew everybody who was involved initially in that. Ray and Debbie Berge and the Zooks, Dave and Pauline.
I interviewed him yesterday.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So yeah, I would have been much more involved later when Noah Salzfus was the pastor there and so on.
What was the reason that, from my understanding from just reading history and talking to some other people and to Dave Zook, was that the Virginia Conference at that time was really strong on founding new churches.
That's true.
And that was one of the pushes, and that Harold was asked to head it up. But what was the reason that he left there?
As far as I know, the congregation, I don't know if it was ever done in an official vote or anything like that. Maybe so, maybe not. But the congregation was expressing, the small congregation was expressing a lot of displeasure with how Harold was giving leadership at that time. I'm pretty sure some of it was undeserved, but nevertheless, that is the case. Harold was, it was a pretty hard time for him to have, it wasn't like he was making big bucks or anything like that. Maybe outreach would have been a big one, and of course, I'm not able to say what might have been legitimate complaints and what was really just unrealistic.
Mount Pleasant had not had very good luck with Norview either.
Yeah.
Were you involved with him when Sam was there for the year he was there? At all?
Just not directly at all, no. I mean, I was in touch enough to hear some things and that kind of thing, but I wasn't really directly involved.
They left the Virginia Conference long before Mount Pleasant did, right?
Oh, yes, yeah.
What were the reasons, from your perspective, that they left the Virginia Conference?
Oh, I was, you know, I was in the semi-annual conference assembly when they removed themselves, and I was very upset. You know, it's basically, I likened it to your parents raise you and feed you and clothe you, you know, all in your growing up years, and then rather suddenly you decide, I really don't like those parents, you know. There was a lot of money that went into that project that came through the larger Virginia Conference. In my estimation, they never acknowledged that, I guess, and think, well, I don't think, this is true. Mm-hmm. So the United States Navy and Regent University became the two sources for adding to the fold. And some really wonderful, wonderful Christians. Did you know,
I don't know anybody over there.
Okay.
Other than Dave Zook, that's it.
And Jerry, right.
Jerry and Miller.
Yeah,
I don't. I've never been into the place.
Anyway, any number of fervent Christians, and you know, maybe a far lesser number that came off the street or whatever, and that suited Noah very much. He was a Methodist pastor before he took this assignment, even though he'd grown up Mennonite. Mm-hmm. So you know, it was no problem for him, but neither did he have any Anabaptist loyalty or, I mean, anything. There was no compulsion or even, in my view, not even a theology that, you know, would emphasize the Sermon on the Mount or pacifism.
That's core Anabaptism.
What's that?
That's core Anabaptism.
Well, it is, right. And don't hear me saying that that Noah was a... In fact, actually, you know, for a couple of years, his wife taught at Mount Pleasant. Mm. So, you know, we... Noah and his wife and Rose and I got along fine and, you know, often talk, that kind of thing. But that mentality, I think, had more to do... I'm not saying it's all just Noah's fault, but, you know, the people who came in... In fact, there was a Navy officer, ranking officer, who came in, Jim...
Jim Captain?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know who you're talking about.
He was on the council later, and he too, you know, a fervent Christian. But I heard him say, prior to the congregation leaving, I heard him say something to the effect, he was asked the question in a smaller council setting. Well, what kind of obligation does Lansdowne have to Virginia Mennonite Conference? Jim said, none. You know, that was, of course, there's a lot of history that came along before he ever became a part of it, but that was his answer, and I think he's very sincere about that.
Well, how did they get hooked up with, what's the name of the outfit in Harrisonburg? They had a bunch of churches and Sam was part of it for a while.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's right.
I can't remember their name now. I don't know why.
And that's what Sam was a part of, too. It's another story, but...
we're a mess. Anyway, we both know who we're talking about. How did they get hooked up with them?
This is the weirdest thing. When they left Virginia Conference, they determined that they didn't want to be non-affiliated. Gerald Martin is the...
Gerald Martin, yeah.
So after...
Cornerstone.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. Okay. We each contributed a part. Cornerstone was their choice. And it took a while. I mean, it was a process, but... then, you know, there were multiple visits by Gerald Martin, and but their next pastor, and it might have been in that, I don't know if exactly when Sam was there.
And I don't think he had anything to do with it.
Okay.
I think it was after Sam.
Yeah. It wasn't long until they had a Cornerstone Supply pastor, and that's been the case ever since.
In fact, they said that when they hired Sam, they sent a delegation, and I guess Dave was among them, to go visit Gerald Martin to ask his advice, and he told them don't do it. You know, that he was too independent and wouldn't, how do you put it, would kick over the traces of authority. You know, he would just...
Yeah, right. You know who the authority was.
And
yeah, it was Gerald.
Yeah.
So please don't write this down. But this is
I'm not looking. I mean, this history I consider is going to be 1,500 pages long at least.
I mean, yeah.
And this section of it is a small part of it, but I want it to be complete and dispassionate. Without pointing any fingers, but just to explain, here is what happened and the personality involved.
Yeah.
And I'm not looking to grand an accent.
Well, and this is more like a personal, private observation, just like the answer that the Zooks got from Gerald Martin. You know, it'd be for every one with an opinion like Gerald's, there would probably be 10 that would say, Sam's a wonderful preacher, and he's, you know, but while I was still pastor, Sam had left Cornerstone, and that's when he and Bev first moved back here to, you know, Wanger Road. Sam came to me, well, I'll just insert this real quick. So, you know, James's good friend was Dave Wright, who was later the idol of... New York Mets.
Okay. And Linda's best, he was also the nephew of Linda's best friend.
Really? Okay. That's cool. Yeah. Well, yeah, fine, folks. But anyway, for some reason, in that move from Harrisonburg, Sam thought of my boys, which is fine, but, and Dave Wright happened to be playing volleyball on our front yard when Sam came over to ask my boys if they'd help, you know, unload his stuff. Mm-hmm. Which, anyway, James to this day just laughs that Dave exited himself appropriately, I guess. he was here to play volleyball, not to get into. just weeks later, Sam came to me and talked about how inappropriately and unkindly Gerald Martin had been to him. And Sam said at that time, and I knew some of the other guys too, but it was 7 or 8 promising young preachers who Mr. Martin had recruited, or, and in some cases trained, and then rejected for whatever, they didn't please him. These guys were really hurt, and for a while they had a regular lament session. I happened to be very, very disappointed when later I heard, of course, not mentioning the exact name, but Sam from the pulpit talking about how unkindly he had been treated by the former pastor. And this, I'm still not sure why he felt it was important to tell the whole congregation about that. But the more troubling thing for me is I saw some behaviors in Sam that seemed to me to be very much like Gerald Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there you go. I'm not perfect. I've made a lot of mistakes in my life, and I wish I had shut my mouth sometimes. But it was unfortunate. And it is true, Gerald actually, the Virginia Conference, the last executive, what do we call him? Executive something. Anyway, he was the CEO of the conference, and he in his evaluation of Gerald Martin, there were again a number of small congregations that had been started in Virginia Conference, all of them probably less than 100 members, and for whatever reasons decided to join with Cornerstone. I think as Cornerstone was itself breaking away from Virginia Conference. So the executive director said, you know, Gerald has actually confiscated Virginia Conference property. He didn't just in some formal fashion say you're now a church of Cornerstone. You know, this property is ours now. Everybody was too kind or naive, one or the other, to contest mm-hmm. that. So that did happen several times where, you know, a lot of Virginia Conference money had gone into starting that church, but it wasn't theirs anymore.
So they're hierarchical enough that the church property actually belongs to Cornerstone?
I don't know if that was across the board or just some unique situations. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about that. There was a church in Elkton that I know for sure that happened, but I don't know how many others.
So they're not affiliated with the Mennonites at all anymore?
There's, depends on which Mennonites.
They're not affiliated with Virginia Conference.
Oh, definitely not affiliated with Virginia Conference, not affiliated with MCUSA or any number of other. I mean, if they are affiliated, it's some kind of group that has Anabaptists in its name, but in my estimation anyway, not much more than that.
Mm.
And I don't know actually how things, I mean, Gerald's still living, but he's, I think, retired now. I don't think there was anybody following him who was as assertive and dominating as Gerald himself was. So, you know, maybe things are better now, more Christ-like.
Well, they couldn't be too Anabaptist if, you know, I mean, we run into this in Mount Pleasant also, just because of the community we live in, but true Anabaptists got to be non-resistant, otherwise it's Anabaptist in my eyes. I mean, if it doesn't fit the definition anymore.
Yeah.
It might still be Christian, but it's not Anabaptist.
Which reminds me, I'm deviating a little bit, and then I got to stop rambling. So there is a worldwide organization now that's just in its beginning stages. It's called Anabaptist World.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a weekly publication that gives little excerpts, little stories of Anabaptists in every country around the globe. So there's a small fee to join, but they're soliciting members now. You can check it out. See, you might be interested. I don't know. I'm not saying.
Well, I used to get Mennonite Week. Was it Mennonite Monthly or something?
Mennonite Weekly Review. Well, there was a newspaper, Mennonite Weekly Review. Is that what you're?
Could be. I used to get it for several years, and then I dropped. I don't know why I did now. And I've gotten some advertisements in the mail from this Mennonite.
Anabaptist World?
Anabaptist World.
Yeah. Okay.
And I've thought about signing up for it, just haven't yet.
The leadership is not the same people that were involved with a Mennonite. What did we say it was? Mennonite
weekly
review?
Or monthly review or something.
Yeah, but you know, some of the stories are the same. I mean, the type of stories.
Well, who are the powers at Lansdowne then? Is it Dave and Jerry? Because they're the original, or I guess the only original members left.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure I can answer that. I don't know. I mean, I certainly see a lot of good things happening in that congregation.
One of the best things is that Dennis Miller has rededicated his life to the Lord and has become a fervent attender and involved.
Well, by the way, I got to tell Sharon Kephart Gowdy this. I didn't get to tell Richard Sunday, but I was so moved by Richard and Diane, is that right? Their comments, and I thought about how pleased Jerry Kephart would be I'm not able to say whether he was watching or not, but I know he'd be pleased. And then Sharon said, and her mother too, and yeah, sure, that's true. But anyway, that was a wonderful thing. Wonderful thing to see that. So,
how much influence do you think it had on some of Sam's problems at the church? The fact that he was with New Life for 7 years or 6 years before he came here. Kelly and Brent went to New Life.
Yeah.
And there's somebody that went to church with him, got married, and we were invited to the wedding because he was a friend of Maggie's, and Maggie was in the wedding. So they put us with the old people who happened to be the deacons and the preacher's wife from New Life.
So
I took the opportunity to ask them how they were organized. Who has the power? Who does what? Who does this? And I was just amazed to find out they have no members. They don't have a membership role. You come, you pay your money. But the church is run by the board, period, who are self-appointed.
And if one self-appointed?
Self-appointed. If one of them leaves, the board picks a replacement. It doesn't go to the congregation. The congregation has no say. And because I couldn't believe it, I kept, wait a minute, congregation, none whatsoever. We are ordained by God.
Now, so this is one group that manages all of the...
Each congregation.
Oh, each congregation has...
This New Life is on Johnstown Road. They split away. The apparently New Life, all churches have these problems. We're all coming together to split apart.
Well, my brother is one of those too. You know, Dan was originally a member of church, but no longer. Even though he still has New Life in the name down there in Coin Jock. But anyway.
And so I was just amazed. I said, you know, well, how different is that? You know, Sam coming out of an organization that is ruled by the preacher and a board who are generally, at least from what I've seen from these people, pretty subordinate to the preacher.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And therefore comes to another situation where it at one time was ruled by bishops.
Yeah.
But over the century, the power has devolved to the congregation, and this congregation has been there so long that, you know, the grassroots has got to be pleased or it doesn't happen.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And that he came in thinking, well, no, you know. And it struck me again when I was talking to him that he mentioned that the Mount Pleasants were not followers.
Mm-hmm.
He thought he was free to run it. And,
yeah.
You know, he would say something and it wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, and
well,
between that and his absolute lack of empathy. I mean, Sam, you know, he is a great preacher and a great evangelist, but his perception of others is severely lacking.
I've got to hand it to Sam, though. One of them was my horse accident. You know, I was in the hospital just overnight, but so it wasn't like a life or death tragedy. But, you know, Sam came to see me, and there have been a couple of other occasions where, well, certainly Rose's death, where, you know, he extended his sympathy. Mm-hmm. And so I just have to acknowledge that he very, very kind to me in some of those situations. So I think you've hit on one, the kind of the dominant leader that, you know, tells everybody else what to do. And
which could also explain some origins of differences with Gerald.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, I won't go on and on about that. The other is that, those who maybe knew Sam better than many and would quickly acknowledge him as a gifted evangelist, and of course preaching could go in. I mean, that's basically how the Shahinis came to the Lord. Deanie in particular, you know, came. But the Bible designates between evangelists and pastors. You know, they're two different assignments.
Real life would.
Yeah, I think that was always another factor too. To Sam's delight, if he could jet off to Indonesia, you know, in the midst of a congregational crisis or something like that, and he had to be on the move and moving around. Bev, bless her heart, I think she's pleased to see him at what he enjoys and feels most gifted in.
She is. In fact, he said that when he first started talking about coming to Mount Pleasant, that she told him, don't do it. I know you, I know them, it won't work. Don't do it. And she kept telling him, don't do it.
Yeah.
And when he ran into problems, he said he was fussing to her about it one night when he was laying in bed, and she looked at him and said, I told you so.
I can totally. I've become so impressed with Bev. She's just amazing. But yeah, so I would say those two things. And can you say either of those are a sin or a,
no?
Well, no, but
they're just lackings, and all of us have different gifts, and all of us have different blind spots.
Yeah, I've certainly found too many of mine along the way over the last 50 years.
Hey, one thing that I have found in doing all these interviews, which is over 40 now, of Mennonites and just people in the community, the people who have long Mennonite backgrounds are much more self-effacing and try to be, well, you know, there's two sides to this.
And,
you know, the humility angle, that old Amish, you can't stick your head above the level there, you know, you got to be humble down here.
Yeah.
Whereas the folks who don't have that are much more
assertive
and, or covering themselves with glory.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, in a little bit, I need to get back to work here, but is there something else that...
That about covers it. Oh, one more thing real quick. Deep Creek, when it closed down over there, I understand it closed down simply because they ran out of members, everybody left Deep Creek, and it was done. And Kenny Kurtz, Dave Zook, our Dave Zook, and somebody else who's Brown, were the trustees, and wanted to sell the building. Do you know anything about that whole transaction thing there?
Well, I know something about it. I Robert Maston, I was very closely involved with him at that point, would have understood the district council to be responsible for its next step, or what, you know what. And I'm not sure how Ken and Dave were they involved with that understanding the district council had, you know, simultaneously, or had they already maybe attempted some efforts at selling the property or whatever?
There was somebody who wanted to buy it.
Okay.
The Methodist preacher down here who split off and was renting the church wanted to buy it.
Oh, who was that?
Right.
Mount Pleasant Methodist. Yeah. Again, I can say his name. I know who you're talking about. Don't know that I was aware that he had expressed that he wanted to buy it, but
I think that's as far as they got. I don't think they ever named a number or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Yeah. So if the district was pulling something out from under them, I feel badly about that. I wouldn't have been aware that was happening. I mean, I guess I was pastor when Mount Pleasant welcomed back into membership a number of people whose membership had, including the Kurtzes and the Zooks, who had been members at Deep Creek. So I'm not sure if mine and Robert's conversation would have been within the district council, whoever was on the council.
I've interviewed Kenny, but we didn't cover this, but I'm going to go talk to him again. From Dave's perspective, they wanted to sell the church, and he said Brother Phil wanted to donate the church to the church in Newport News.
Right, Calvary.
Calvary. And they opposed it, so they were fired and just put off to the side. Mm. And he thinks it's because Brother Phil was going senile.
Mm.
Now, I don't, you know, I'm going to talk to Kenny to get his perspective on what happened. But he said his objection was, we already had a church there that was operating. Why are we going to, and they want to pay us money for it.
Yeah.
Why are we going to give it to a black church on the other side of the water in the middle of a white community?
It
doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And he said, well, Phil, or he attributed it to Phil being determined, and everybody else just went along with Phil. Apparently left a little bad taste in his mouth.
Oh, of course, sure. Well, and there was a cemetery thing too, which Amos and Rebecca Lehman had some loved ones in that cemetery.
And two Zooks and Roy Payne.
Okay. So what, is Dave's mother in there?
Mother and father. Dave's father is actually buried in...
up in South Boston or somewhere up there, right?
His gravestone's in our cemetery, but he's buried in South Boston.
Okay. Yeah, bless his heart.
It's been interesting being the graveyard monitor.
Well, there were a lot of glitches, I think, in that whole process, and some things that looked initially too good to be true. So I can't really comment on that, and I wasn't in on any conversation that Phil would have had with Dave and with Ken. But I certainly was in on some of the conversations with Calvary. Robert Mast, I think, was leading the council at that point in that thing. And what I do know is that for reasons I don't fully understand, but it was an exciting kind of movement, Calvary had become involved somehow with South Africa and some churches in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know about all of that. But there was a guy, a very fervent pastor, who was coming to the U.S., wanted to be somehow a part of what Calvary was doing. Well, I guess the church was given to Calvary just in time that he was able to his assignment, his Calvary-related assignment was to pastor what had been the West Road Church. And initially, it was just really exciting to see, this guy was on fire. He soon got a lot of rapport. And here was a small church that seemed, I mean, church building that seemed very appropriate, you know, in terms of the size and all that. And then you know what City Chesapeake did. Cut off West Road.
Oh, yeah, at the end, yeah.
And suddenly, so these urban folks, wherever they're coming from, whether it's Deep Creek or Suffolk or Newport News or wherever, if it was an evening meeting, they couldn't find their way in the dark. It's understandable. I can't find my way over there anymore.
You got to want to know to be there. You got to really want to go to be there.
Yeah, exactly. You got to wind around back there behind Grassfield High School and all that. Anyway, you should hear the folks that have the flowers over there on Shillelagh. Christina Tewin. She's just so upset with that whole thing. You know, she would just be a couple of blocks from where the church was. So long story short, not only did that, and then on top of that, of all things, the brother and his family got into some kind of immigrant snag. They didn't have the right papers at the right time or something. They got sent back to South Africa.
Okay.
So the whole thing blew up. I mean, you know, it wasn't as feasible.